I just heard it's like a million voices cried out all at once, and then they were gone. And as Gabe reads to fucking door.
Welcome to episode 13.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
Doing very well, doing very well. I'm officially done teaching for the semester, which is a really lovely, lovely feeling.
Oh, congratulations. So your last class was today?
Yes, this is my last class bash right now.
Oh, that's great. And I understand that to add a little insult to injury, you had to go to something called Popcorn and Professors.
That's not an injury at all. That's a promotional event for the department, happy to put that service time in.
That's right, Ken's promotion committee. We know you're listening and we know you heard it here first, and there's nothing Ken loves more than popcorn and being a professor. So we're sponsored, as we are every fortnight here, by the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick and by a ULETH Exchange grant. And we thank them for their support of this podcast. It enables things like hiring the producer, which meant that Ken actually was able to finish his semester with almost as much hair as he started it with, because he wasn't editing in our in ClipChamp. We've got a manual on that now. And so we thank them, and as always, listener, you will be the first to know when the APANV gets a website. We will we'll launch it here, perhaps.
Yeah, right in the show notes.
That's right. So Ken, the listener may have noticed that we're still called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And that's a fine name, really, but it doesn't have quite the kind of excitement that we might go for, especially as we see our listens creeping up on our RSS feed. Yep. And as we try to better bring not just New Brunswick archaeology to the people, but the people to New Brunswick archaeology. So we're trying to do that. And one of the ways to do that is with a snappy name. So Ken, we like to open up to the listener an opportunity to send in a new name, and if we end up picking that new name, we'll give them a prize. That's how this works. And Ken, if they had that new name, where would they email it to?
They would email it to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And this week we've got a prize that's not just exciting, it's responsible. So Ken, last fortnight we chatted with a bunch of bioarchaeologists about life at the Fortress of Lewisburg, and then I was able to have a very enjoyable evening at the Skeletal Story event here at UNB, and I learned about things like leg amputations, falling off bastions and demi-bastions while cut to the gills on high-test naval strength Courvoisier, ribs crushed in brawling, and tibias with breaks so severe they looked like they were inflicted by a Mazda Miata. And Ken, do you know what everyone we learned about had in common?
I don't.
Ken, they were pining for the fjords. They were no more. They had ceased to be. They had expired and gone to meet their maker. They were late French or New Englander soldiers, bereft of life, resting in peace. They'd run down the curtain and they'd join the choir invisible. And so death, of course, is a topic. It's so profound. It's fascinated some of the great poets of the Western canon. I'm thinking of luminaries like William Blake, W.H. Auden, Emily Dickinson, and even Tupac Shakur. And like Tupac said, though memories fade, I got your name tatted on my arm. So we both bawl till my dying days. Before I say goodbye, Cato and Mental, rest in peace. Thug till I die.
Right now, there's going to be an audible gasp heard across the landscape. It's like It's like that scene in Star Wars where Obi-Wan Kenobi says, I just heard, it's like a million voices cried out all at once, and then they were gone. And as Gabe reads Tupac Shakur to the listening audience.
I guess it's the first time I haven't been able to get through one. So I'll reread the.
Oh, no, this is all staying.
No, we're doing it. Okay. And with that final syllable, Tupac invoked the universal cosmic mandala, the alpha and the omega, the top of the first and the bottom of the ninth. And Ken, you know what I bet Tupac was thinking that September night in Vegas as he left the Seldon Tyson fight at the MGM Grand Garden Arena and headed to the intersection of East Flamingo Road and Koval Lane?
I'd probably not what happened next.
Yeah, well, we can't know what he was thinking, but I do wonder if he was thinking about term life insurance. That's right, Ken. The Grim Reaper's gonna reap, whether it's by crushing you under a 24 Livre, that's about 400 Scottish Troy's cannon, or a drive-by on the Vegas Strip, you need to make sure your loved ones are looked after when the last cricketer leaves the crease. And that's why the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast is partnering with ARC Direct to bring the lucky listener who sends the new name for this podcast 500,000 Canadian, that's 138 Yankee pesos, of 10-year fixed-rate term life insurance with an option to convert to permanent at any point up to the age of 85. So, listener, if you're grilling this weekend with the guys, ask yourself, would my loved ones be taken care of if I was killed by cannon fire in a month-long siege of this yard? Here at the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, we don't think you can afford to wait, because today's lucky listener may be tomorrow's bioarchaeological case study. So, listener, if you've got a new name for the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, don't wait, send it in now. And Ken, where would they send it?
They would send that email to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That is both a practical and I think just practical. It's a very practical prize that to have that life insurance to, and you know, for our listening audience, it shows how much we care.
It does.
About their, yeah, but
and it shows how much we know they care too. I think that's the important thing, is that we know that the listener to this program is the sort of person that that wants to think ahead, you know?
Exactly.
So Ken, speaking of thinking ahead, you mentioned to me that there was mail, although you haven't read it. And so if you go to that mailbox, we just encourage the listener to send in their winning prize read to, what's in it?
We have several emails, actually.
Oh, my goodness.
Gmail says there's 25 unread emails. Many of these are from a website that I must have signed up to called qrcode.com. They keep persistently telling me that our trial has run out. There was also, I think, 30 unread emails from Squarespace, all of which appear to be a 20% off our next website. But we're gonna navigate through that pile, and we're gonna first read an email from Paul titled Podcast Names. Hey guys, new listener, first time emailer, longtime Gabe fan.
Welcome to the show, Paul.
Yeah, first off, fun live podcast. I don't know archaeology at all, but was entertained. Secondly, Emmanuel's cool guy, laid back ASMR voice on the last episode gave me confusing feelings and tingles.
All right, there you go,
Emmanuel. That dude should be reading sexy stories for lonely wives for a podcast with those sultry pipes.
Well, Paul, anyway. He is. It's not under his real name. We'll send you a link later.
Yeah. Anyway, here are a non-archaeologist, typical American idiot's ideas for podcast names. 1, not Oak Island. 2, the dirt on New Brunswick. 3, just the facts, New Brunswick. 4, sieving New Brunswick. Or sieving
New
Brunswick.
That's a good one. Yeah.
And my favorite, 5, New Brunswick Trowler Trash. you can add, quote, ? To the end of any of those as well. Good luck with the podcast, Paul. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you so much, Paul. And Paul, if you're the Paul I think you are, I think I'm seeing you for dinner in a few days here. So I'm looking forward to seeing you. And I'm a longtime Paul fan, too. So thanks for the suggestions.
Yes. All right. So, and now we have Lacey, who has a name suggestion. Hey there, Gabe and Ken. The name suggestion, quote, trowels and tribulations hit me during a late night study session recently. Something like, quote, trowels and tribulations, : Northeastern archaeology with Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke, unquote. I fear this is my magnum opus. Looking forward to hearing what you think. All the best, Lacey.
But I tell you, Ken, we're very close to having a number of people's families well looked after.
Exactly.
We're getting real close.
These people want the insurance policy.
They do. It almost makes you wonder. I mean, like, what are they planning? I'll make Paul test my drink first this Friday.
Okay. Exactly. All right. So John, his email is called Toponymy Talk. Ken and Gabe, hello from the banks of Glacial Lake Acadia. I just wanted to write in and say how much I loved your discussion about river toponymy last week. If there's enough content here to make a whole show about toponymy someday, I would be a very happy listener. Best, John. Well, John, I think we can probably do that. And we will take that into consideration. That'd be something we could get Jason Hall on to talk about.
I think that would be a great Jason Hall topic. Mally Moran as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Chris Shaw actually talked a little bit about rivers. So, I mean, we could do a season.
Yeah, we could. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. And then, we have an email here from Anuj, who says, entitled "The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast featured in FeedSpot's top 25 New Brunswick podcasts." So Anuj is the founder of FeedSpot, and he would like to personally congratulate us as our podcast, the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, has been selected by our panelist as one of the top 25 New Brunswick podcasts on the web. So it looks like all we need to do is give him our credit card information, Gabe, and our social insurance numbers. And it looks like we will probably win. We will be formally placed in that top 25.
So Ken, when I introduce it in the future, do I have to say, welcome back to the award-winning New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast?
all it takes is probably your credit card and your credit score for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Well, Anuj, if this was top 10, we'd be interested, but Ken and I have some sense of self-worth, and we're not sure that being the top 25 is what we're going for here.
And our final email is from David Black, and says, boats and ambiguity. Hi, Ken and Gabe. The weather in Freddy is wet and gloomy, so I'm catching up on my podcast listening. I enjoyed your episode about boats very much. This is a great example of how lack of preservation of some past technologies skews our interpretations of those technologies that are preserved. In my flightier moments, I envision a past where flotillas of canoes circulated around the Bay of Fundy and the Gulf of Maine, the canoeists acquiring and exchanging everything from scrapers to ceramics to stories and songs. And thanks especially for your hilarious disambiguation of marmot from marmite. Not things one wants to confuse. You reminded me of the Monty Python skit about getting a squeeze of, quote, lemming in one's martini, or dare I suggest, one's Courvoisier. Cheers, Dave. Well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm glad to hear you're catching up on things. So that is it for the mailbox this week, but mailbag, I guess would be it was a heavy load.
Ken, if someone were to send in more email to us to fill up that mailbox even further, where would they send it to?
They're going to send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And we also have social media. We have an Instagram handle, which I can't, if you give me a moment here, I can pull up what that is. It might be just at New Brunswick Archaeology, isn't it?
It might be. And while Ken is pulling that up, I'll also point out that I believe, Ken, we have some of the hottest web space available on the web, that we are newbrunswickarchaeology.com, are we not?
We are newbrunswickarchaeology.com, and archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. Where do you see what our handle is?
Oh, that's, you just keep talking, Ken, and I'll try to check this as I pull up our Instagram here. The listener can't see this, but Ken is actually, he's pretending to be looking for our Instagram, but he's been sucked in by a TikTok video. And it's but in fact, listener, we're not on TikTok, but we are new_NEW_Brunswick_archaeology. And how would you spell archaeology, Ken?
ARCHAEOLOGY.
That's right. And we love to have followers on Instagram. So Ken, we've got a very special treat for the listener tonight.
We do. It's a spooky treat.
It's spooky season here on the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. And so Chris Wolf's going to be on. He's going to talk about Newfoundland. He's going to talk about the archaeology of fear. I thought it was a really interesting episode. Chris, is a really interesting guy, and he's done all sorts of I, in fact, remember the first time I emailed Chris was about that house feature. He was talking about being killed.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. That's the was that the Dorset Longhouse?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or sorry, Maritime Archaic Longhouse, I believe. Right.
Oh, maybe that's what it like. Nulliac Cove or something.
Yeah. And his dissertation. Yep.
Yeah. OK. Yeah. Very cool. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think we've talked about it on the show before. But yeah, I think we've talked about it on the show before. But Chris and Don have their infamous dinner at the SAAs where they invite somebody out for to kind of chat for the evening with a group of like interesting individuals. And I got treated to that last year at the SAAs. So there's going to be three new lucky participants this year that I'm sure we'll have lots of fun with that. I'm curious too. Chris also, I said that it's a shame that we don't get to go to New Orleans. I said I was really looking forward to the beignets. But he said he'll eat some for us, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we appreciate that. And in fact, I mean, the listener, part of the reason that this is an audio only podcast is that the listener would know if they were watching this that I don't need any more beignets in my life. So in fact, Chris is really taking one for the team with me here. It's not just that he has the fantastic hairline and and all that. He's
come visit us at the CAA in Saskatoon. We'll be. I believe we'll be recording podcast content there. And we are presenting a poster in one of the poster sessions on the podcast. And so if you haven't learned enough about the podcast listening to it, you could come see our summary of it in poster form in Saskatoon.
That's right. And it's actually very useful because we understand the listener who's been trying to learn how to spell archaeology may not. If you're a visual learner rather than an oral learner, you may need Ken to help you with the poster.
Yeah.
So listener, we will talk to you in about a fortnight. We'll hopefully see you in Saskatoon. And we think you're really going to enjoy this interview with Chris.
Yep. And we'll be back after the interview, not in a fortnight.
So tonight we're joined by Dr. Chris Wolf, who's an associate professor of anthropology at the University at Albany SUNY. His graduate degrees are from the Memorial University of Newfoundland and Southern Methodist University. His work focuses on the far northeast, especially Newfoundland and Labrador. There he's engaged with a number of exciting research topics, including the peopling of Newfoundland, the use and manufacture of drums in Arctic and subarctic cultures, hunter-gatherer domestic architecture, and how past cultures may have reacted to fear or used fear for their own advantage. Just this week, his paper, Culture on the Rocks, Maritime Archaic Resilience, Sustainability, and Abandonment on the Island of Newfoundland is out in the book Sustainability in Ancient Island Societies and Archaeology of Human Resilience, and his papers have appeared in a number of other edited volumes and journals, including North Atlantic Archaeology, Arctic Anthropology, Remote Sensing, and North American Archaeologists. Thanks for joining us, Chris. How are you tonight?
Good. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Listener can't see this, but it's dark in Albany, and that's going to match some of the topics Chris is going to tell us about here later, as we delve into fear.
I'm in a dark Victorian office right now to talk about this.
Yeah, he's got a flashlight under his chin right now, so you can picture the spooky spooky manor basically is the background. And Chris, this is your second appearance on the podcast, actually, almost a year to the date.
Yeah, brief. Appearance from the conference and the SAAs, right?
Yeah. I had my small blue microphone with me kind of grabbing people in the conference in the book room. Yeah. Or whatever the big open conference hall, with all the vendors and free pens.
Book room feels like what my students sort of flail about and they refer to the library as, you know, the book room.
The best part of every conference.
Yeah, exactly. So, Chris, you and your colleagues have been working at Stock Cove in southeastern Newfoundland. And what can you tell us about that site? Could you give us a little bit of a summary?
Yeah, well, we haven't worked there for a few years. We actually worked at a different site in Spectre Island, which I have yet to write up fully. So it's wouldn't be expected for anybody to know about that. But it's another maritime archaic site and bathymetric site. But Stock Cove is still sort of the love of my life in terms of sites in Newfoundland. It's a multi-component site that has basically every culture that lives on the island of Newfoundland in one place. So I liked it because it had a setting that everybody was attracted to, except for maybe the Norse. We thought we had some Norse material at one point. We got overly excited and then really scared that it was actually Norse. And it turned out to be not. So we have mixed feelings about that. But you know, really deeply buried, which is strange for the island, you know, known as the Rock for a reason. We have a deeply buried maritime archaic component with a probable house structure. We have early Paleo Inuit gross water, a huge Dorset, probably one of the richest Dorset sites, if not, you know, at least per unit, 1 by 1 meter units, maybe the richest Dorset site known on the island right now, if not, you know, the biggest. Port of Choix probably takes that prize. But then it also has, you know, early ancestral Beothic little passage and others kind of right up into European colonial period material. So it's this great site that has this layer cake of really fascinating materials. And it was just a really heavily used and intensive occupation there.
Yeah, I was reading the description. I don't know if it was you or Don described that at one point you just sort of stopped digging in the Dorset component and just picked up end blades by hand.
Yeah, it was an end blade factory for the Dorset. Just beautiful too. They were making these end blades and they were chipping them out of this gray Trinity Bay chert, is what we call it. We don't really know the source of where it comes from, but close by because of the amount of it in this area. But they were chipping it and then they were grinding away the flake scars and they're serrating the edges and making these really beautiful end blades. And it's almost annoying how much it slows you down, because every time you put your trowel in the dirt, another one kind of pops up and you're like, oh, now I have to record this. But we have over 600 end blades from less than 20 square meters of Dorset.
Wow. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's tough, Chris. We feel really bad for you. So what is it that's attracting people to that environmental setting, do you think?
Well, there's a really, the cove itself is really deep. It's a nice protected area. So it's like a nice kind of amphitheater, almost parabolic in shape. And there's a huge cliff on one side, just kind of to the north. That would have protected them from like really harsh north winds. So it's a nice protected site. It's one of my favorite places to camp for those reasons too. And it doesn't take very long for you to get into really deep water. So just like 30 meters off the shore there, you have whales swimming by and there's an upwelling current there. So it's a really rich biome. So we have, you know, there's seals when the sea ice is there. Probably we know that there's harp seals that get attracted to the area. And most of the fauna that we found in the, we have very little bone, but the bone we have seems to be almost all harp seal. So, and there's fish and shellfish. I mean, it's a really rich marine environment there for sure. And earlier ideas were that people were also attracted there because it's a short portage over to the south side of the island, because it's on the isthmus part of the island. For people who know Newfoundland, it's the isthmus that goes out to the Avalon Peninsula. It's kind of right at the base of it as the island broadens out. So it would have been a short travel if you wanted to get to the south coast. So it might have been a place sort of to get over there and maybe even intercept caribou that are kind of making their way along that narrow isthmus. But we haven't found any caribou. So
yeah, that's cool.
Interesting.
So just to catch the listener up a little bit about that's the time frames we're talking about here. So we're talking about Dorset, and we're talking about maritime archaic, and we're talking about Beothic and ancestral Beothic. Could you just sort this out for us, Chris? Because it's a busy island before and around the time of contact.
Yeah, I'm going to get this wrong, and somebody will be mad at me about this. But and I'm writing a paper right now about sort of the earliest kind of doing a chronometric hygiene paper about the peopling of Newfoundland, calibrating all the dates. It seems like the maritime archaic got there at least no later than 6,500 BP, 6,500 years ago, maybe a little bit earlier. Some people think it's earlier, but I have my doubts about that for various reasons. But by at least 6,500, they're on the island. They seem to quickly have made their way around the edges of the island and colonized it. Because at Stock Cove, which is on the southeastern part of the island, we have dates that are over 5,000. We have some points that seem to be closer to kind of things you find around 6,000 years ago. So they seem to have gotten over there pretty quick. And they're on the island really until about 3,200 years ago, archaic people. And then there's a what we seem to see in the archaeological record as a hiatus. I'm sure it's not a complete hiatus, but we don't really have any dates between 3200 and 2800 BP. There seems to be about 400 years where there's very little occupation. And then we have Paleo-Inuit, kind of gross water, early Paleo-Inuit moving onto the island around that time. Dorset come on the island around, I don't know, it depends on whether you think the gross water or early Dorset or not. You know, if there's in situ, there's all kinds of theories that I go back and forth about. But the Dorset were also Paleo-Inuit coming from the Arctic down onto the island, probably close to 2200 is what we usually put around, somewhere in there. They're on the island to about 1200 or so BP. Meanwhile, in other parts of the island, there are also Amerindian people coming on to the island that are the ancestors of the Beowulf. There's the Cowhead people that seem to come on relatively early on, maybe around the same time as the gross water, 2,800 years ago or so. Very small populations, perhaps. And then we have beaches and Little Passage, which now we think are mostly sort of ancestral forms of that are known as the Beothic in the colonial period. And so they occupy and share the island, but with a more, so the Dorset, I don't know how much your listeners want to hear about this, but the Dorset are more kind of a specialized economy, marine, coastal. The ancestral Beothic are more of a mixed economy, more kind of coastal as well as interior, as much as they could. And so they seem to have sort of shared the island for a long time, for over at least a couple thousand years, perhaps.
Yeah, and for the listener too, so, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the Dorset sort of don't have a descendant population, but the Amerindian groups that arrive in Newfoundland have the Beothic follow, but they would be more closely related to like the ancestor of the Inu, like contemporary Innu would be correct, right?
Well, probably. I mean, this becomes kind of politically fraught in some regards. Yeah, so the Beothic remain on the island as the Dorset abandon it, maybe having to do with climate change and sea ice. I think it has, most of these things have to do with sea ice presence and ecosystems. But so the Beothic stay, we know them to be on the island until at least 1829 is the last known Beothic woman, Shauna Dithit, dies of tuberculosis. And what happens to them exactly in terms of their demise culturally, and many people believe them to be become culturally extinct. They did seem to have some connections to mainland groups, and that would have been the mountaineer back then, according to all the, so the Montagnais and the Innu, and there's some, you know, connection to those in terms of descendancy. They probably didn't become biologically extinct. They maybe, the remaining smaller groups might have assimilated into some of those groups. We don't know, because that's not really showing up in the archaeological record. We don't see all of a sudden a Beothic influence on the mainland or anything like that, that I know of, at least. But the Beothic aren't really, haven't been in the past my focus. They're becoming more of a focus for me. But when I say politically fraught, it's because there are some Mi'kmaq groups that are claiming Beothic as an island version or relationships with them. But the historical record seems to differ on that account, as biased as it is. So that needs to be looked at archaeologically. And so that's kind of some of the intent that Don Hawley and I are thinking about doing next, is looking at those kinds of what actually happened from the Beothic side of things rather than just from the historical record, you know, the written record, which, you know, is valuable, but has to be examined and critically, in a critical way.
Sort of looking at like connections with the Maritimes more generally, eh?
Yeah. Well, to see if there are connections. I mean, when you read the Hawley and some of the early historical accounts about the island, it seems like the Beothic and the Mi'kmaq were actually enemies, if anything. And it seems like from that, those records and from the archaeological record, as we know it today, that the Mi'kmaq were actually, who have a presence on the island now and have had some since the early colonial period, may have only had that since the colonial period. So they might have been actually a relatively recent movement onto the island, according to some of the... Now, this might get me in trouble too, you know, so I'm a little hesitant to wade into this because I'm not really the expert on this, but that's something that needs to be looked into. Like also the antiquity of the Mi'kmaq presence on the island is something that hasn't really been a focus of archaeology. So there's some opportunities there, I think, to work with the Mi'kmaq, work with the Con River Band on the West Coast, and maybe try to look at some of that presence to see if those claims are valid or not. But they seem to not really line up with what the written record and written accounts say about that story.
Yeah, interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
So as we're thinking, though, about fitting Newfoundland kind of into North America in general, so it's occupied, obviously, later than much of the rest of the continent. And how does it fit into kind of our archaeological understanding of the colonization of North America or just colonization in general? I know that's one of your interests.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before. The peopling of the Americas didn't stop with, you know, the Paleo-Indian period. It continues. Labrador and much of Canada still had glacial coverage, or, you know, the succession of plants and the ecosystems hadn't progressed enough to draw up the things that would attract people to those places. So Southern Labrador, Southern Quebec, places like that, really into the early Holocene, weren't probably very habitable in the interior areas. So much of the colonization of that is coastal by necessity, you know. I think some of it is, and some of this is hypothetical because there hasn't been enough research, but people living just north of me here in New York would have been relatively Arctic adapted peoples during the late Pleistocene, early Holocene, right? And as the glaciers move off, you know, we see the formation of things like in the early Holocene of the Champlain Sea, which is this big inland sea that comes through, you know, would have come through the St. Lawrence as we know it today and into New York and Vermont and created this big inland sea that was attached to the North Atlantic. And so people were living around that. We know during the Paleo-Indian period, people were living around that and probably were somewhat coastally adapted to that environment. So a lot of the ways I see it is that some of that, as the Champlain Sea was making its way out, as it was kind of the land was rising as the glaciers were moving on and the rebound was occurring, that and that was disappearing, it was pulling with it some of these coastally adapted peoples, at least how I've always envisioned this kind of peopling. So it's still sort of Arctic coastal adaptations that were being pulled into those coasts of the North Shore of Quebec and Labrador. And by at least 8,000 or 9,000 years ago, we find them on the coast of Labrador, just not too far from the island of Newfoundland. But for some reason, we don't see any evidence of them kind of making that crossing, even though on a good day, you can see across the Strait of Belle Isle until much later.
And there were at least 6 of those good days last year, right? I mean, it was that clear for...
Yeah. You know, the timing has to be right to see, yeah, to see that.
Yeah, because you have Lancemore that's like around 9,000 years old, which is basically right across from the northern tip of Newfoundland.
Yeah, it's closer to 8,000.
8,000, yeah, okay. And then you don't see groups before the Maritime Archaic basically on the island. So that kind of around 6,500 years ago is when there's sort of a first archaeological picture of people making their way onto the island.
Right. And interestingly, the earliest sites are right where we'd expect them to be if they're crossing from the mainland to the northern peninsula of the island, because it's right there in the Bella Strait Isle region. So you would think if it was those weren't the earliest sites, you would find similar kinds of dates elsewhere on the island at that time. But we see like almost like a movement from the west to east in the dates currently. Like I said, I'm working on a paper that will publish some of this soon, hopefully. But that kind of leads me to believe that, well, they're the earliest dates are where we'd expect them to be. They're on that right there near the coast, the mainland. But there's still like a 2000 year gap for, you know, for them making that little crossing. And so why? And, yeah. I have various ideas about that. Mostly is like, why should they? They probably did, but they didn't need to establish a settlement there because there wasn't much there for them to kind of move. And they probably would have been relatively small population. So why keep expanding when you don't have a population to support it? I think that once the climate kind of ameliorates and it creates a better condition so they can make their way up the northern Labrador coast, we see them doing that shortly, you know, by 7,000 or 6,500 years ago, they find Rama Chert way up in northern Labrador. So they're making their way up there and they're starting, then I think there actually has a little bit of a fluorescence in the population. And we see that even within the radiocarbon dates as a proxy, that the population might have reached a point where budding onto the island made sense. That's kind of my working hypothesis right now.
That's cool. Very cool. And we can foreshadow a little bit that one of the hit pieces we're going to do, I forgot to mention that Chris is also the editor of Northeast Anthro, and they just published a paper by Brian Jones about models about Paleo-Indian colonization. And so, but what you were just talking about kind of reminded me about like thinking about how it is exactly that people kind of go out and try out new places and then other folks move in, or do they go back, and how this unfolds. I thought that was an interesting paper, and what you're talking about kind of reminds me of that.
I was really happy about that paper. I mean, it was non-peer reviewed, obviously, because we lost Brian Jones way too young. And so I was happy to put it out there to get some of his ideas out there in sort of a rough form, but still, I think, important ideas. But, I think you have to, and one of the things, even when we talk about fear, I'm always like, what were the people thinking about? I try to put myself into sort of a humanizing position of like, what would it look like to those people there? And you have this big island that would have been interesting and maybe useful, but you don't have a population to, you know, to make that, which is a dangerous crossing, even with modern watercraft, is crossing the Bella Strait Isle. And you're probably working with dugout canoes that are really best suited to kind of hug the coast. And to make that crossing is also, there would have had to be some reason that you'd want to make that crossing regularly to set up, you know, settlements over on that side. So if you don't have a population for it, why?
Yeah. How many people disappeared in the fog, basically, to
yeah.
That probably kept you from going across the crossing.
Well, it's the people appearing from the fog you have to worry about. Oh.
yeah.
Both.
Cool. So Chris, you're talking about fear, I guess. And so and you did, I think, a session at an SAA meeting a few years ago. Was it Fear and Loathing in the Archaeological Record?
Yes. Yeah. That was the first one.
Yeah. Cool. And you've done a few since then. Could you give us just a sort of rundown on what this is? Tell us about fear and your work on it.
Yeah. It's the subject that's taken up most of my time these days for various reasons. The first idea that I came up with was just like I was saying, trying to humanize the past. I got tired of going to a bunch of talks. You know, I love artifacts as much as the next guy, but we always teach our students like the artifacts aren't really that important. What's really important is what the value of the information we can learn from those artifacts. And I started wondering like how valuable is that information if we're paying so much attention to like metrics and statistical analyses and all these things that we have to do and are important.
You know, but, Chris, you can talk to your doctor about end blade fatigue if you need to. You know, like they have drugs. I think it's like a little bit of Wellbutrin, and you can square that right away.
Yeah, I've got a quarry that I'm working at there that I can bring you over for if you want something less exciting.
Well, I mean, my PhD, I counted and weighed and sifted through like 15,000 pieces of debitage from a longhouse, so it's. I'm all for that. I love doing that. Actually, I love sitting down with, especially with students, and just working with debitage and probably boring the hell out of them. But that's sort of how my trial by fire for my students is like, if they can stick with me through the debitage analysis, then I'll invest more time in them. So I see value in all of that. But for me, it was like we weren't thinking about the people, you know, from a kind of human perspective enough. people who think and feel and do both rational and irrational things. And I started thinking about what is the most influential thing that affects our decision-making, affects our behaviors, affects so many aspects of our lives. And that's fear. I think at first I was even kind of worried that everything would become just sort of, reduced to just, you know, I could see fear in everything. And I was afraid people were like, well, you know, everything is about fear. Like, you know what? So everything is just fear. And I'm like, and I was kind of worried about that. But now I'm like, I think everything is really about fear. I mean, I think everything, every decision, like think about all the decisions we make. There's usually some weighing of risk and fear of some outcome that is undesirable within it. So I started figuring out if there are ways that we can actually identify fear in the past and try to get into the cognitive, I mean, it's a version of cognitive archaeology, try to think about people as emotional human beings that were, I mean, fear is sometimes a very rational response. In many cases, the reason why we're here as a species is because our ancestors feared predators and did things to avoid, you know, getting eaten. It can be very rational, but it can also be very irrational. So trying to see a lot of those things leave material evidence that we can actually see. I'm actually talking about in this essays, I'm doing a paper on the architecture of fear. So looking at architecture as a material evidence of various fears and cultures and how they change through time.
You can talk about this maybe in the context of the architecture, but like I had written down, is it disorder? Is it abandonment and stuff like that? But it's probably kind of a mix of like, it's, there can be very orderly fear, but then there can be really disorderly fear. Like I'm guessing that there's patterning kind of on both sides that suggests sort of abrupt reactionary stuff, but then also like kind of prepping, like you have two interesting papers. One of them is, it looks like probably a pre-contact analysis. And then another one is prepping for the end and looking at more sort of contemporary archaeology and so how do they contrast to one another and do you see sort of different patterning and what fear is looking like in the archaeological record in these two?
Well, I can start with the prepping for the end. Sometimes it's best to start at the end, but that's a poster that one of my grad students, Dan Wilcox, is the main presenter on, and he and I did a study of nuclear fallout shelters on our campus. So I'm a Cold War kid. I'm an old, you know, older guy. And we used to have all these, we knew where the Cold War shelters were. We had to do drills where we covered our heads, duck and cover, as if that was going to help us be somehow saved from nuclear explosions.
Yeah, that didn't even work in Indiana Jones. They needed the fridge.
Yeah, if only we had thought of the fridge earlier. I mean, we could have all just had fridges.
Yeah.
Get little mini fridges for like the kindergartners and stuff. But I was thinking about this because I didn't know we had nuclear fallout shelters, and something just crossed. I don't know how I found out about it originally. I think maybe my student found out about them first. And I'm like, huh, it's interesting that fear in our culture has changed so much from the Cold War, that these things were actually, Rockefeller in the 60s made it by law that all municipal buildings had to have fallout shelters put in them for the neighborhoods and people to be able to congregate in them. So our university was built in the 60s and it had to have a fallout shelter. So there's one under each of the dorms on the four corners of our university, how it's laid out. And I asked my I started asking students that live in the dorms, did you know that there's fallout shelters? And none of them knew anything about it. So they don't even know they're there. So our cultural fear has changed so much that we went from having to have them by law in our buildings to not even knowing they're there. And I thought that was really interesting because our cultural fears, in this case, existential fears on a broad cultural level of being, you know, annihilated by nuclear war, has changed so much, even though we're probably at much of risk of that as any time in the past. So it's interesting. Our fears have now changed to now municipal buildings are being designed to thwart things like mass shootings and stuff like that. So architecture reflects the timely context of fears. And so in these places, there's still, however, big fresh water tanks with filters and chemical toilets and like people, places for people to live underground for, you know, however long it took for the fallout to settle. So there's these material elements there. And you can see that also, you know, in fallout shelters that are personal across the landscape too. But I was particularly interested in kind of larger municipal fallout shelters. So that's what that paper is about.
After the SAAs in Washington, I kind of marveled at how DC, how deep the subway, like you seem to be just like on an escalator for like 5 minutes to get down to the railway. And it's because like they function as fallout shelters, is my understanding, is the motivation there for having them so deep.
Yeah, some of it's that. And we have like a Greenbrier, West Virginia. There's a whole fallout place where all the Congress is supposed to go and live out, you know, the fallout. So there's a place that is specially built for our government to sort of go underground for as long as it takes to come out to meet the new mutant overlords or whatever that are going to be out there waiting for them.
The mole people versus the mutants.
Yeah.
Chud. That's why they have a golf course at the Greenbrier so they can get that. That's cool. Yeah, Chris, everyone at the University of Connecticut knew where those fallout shelters were for just in case we lost in the Final Four. You need to retreat somewhere during the riots, you know, but don't worry. Well,
Albany will have it. Albany, we're not in fear of the Final Four anytime soon, I don't think. Our women's team was pretty good this year, but they didn't quite make the tournament.
Oh, good. Yeah. So you've talked a little bit about the architecture of fear. One of the other things that you're a musician. Am I right that you were in an alt band, an alt country band called The Shivers?
Yeah, a long time ago in Portland. We were on Restless Records. We were on a tour for a little bit. I was with them for maybe a little over a year. Yeah.
Yeah. Good review in Rolling Stone I saw when I was doing the show prep.
Yeah, it was a nice band. It was a good band.
No way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like. I was looking for to listen to you guys online to find it, but I hadn't tracked it down yet. But one of the things you've extended this to is, I saw you were the drummer in The Shivers, but you also work on Dorset drums. Does this relate to fear or kind of like an oral soundscape or tell us about that?
No, that actually, some of my interest in that postdates the fear. I mean, there are elements with that because some of my fear research has, you know, I've gotten interested in shamanistic practices, which are often ways to mitigate fear of spiritual elements, fear of creating rituals to alleviate fear and anxiety when, you know, in terms of like hunting animals that you believe to have spirits that need to be honored and respected in certain ways, or, you know, there's a lot of shamanistic rituals or, you know, animistic rituals more broadly that are very much about alleviating fear. And ritual itself, there's some really interesting psychological and cultural anthropological research on ritual acting, even non-spiritual kind of rituals acting to alleviate anxiety. And so the invention of ritual is and the elements of ritual are sometimes something I'm really interested in. I'm really interested in things like apotropaic symbols, things that keep out evil in various places, you know. So the fear, you know, to get to Ken's point earlier, the fear is really happens at different scales. Sometimes it's very individualistic, but has material components, even to like hanging a horseshoe above your doorway to keep, you know, bad luck in or bad luck out, or things like that. So apotropaia stuff, and to, you know, really large scale architecture and architecture too. I've my PhD work was looking at a ritually killed structure. You know, part of it was focused on that. So where they were obviously afraid of something if they didn't do these particular kinds of ritualistic steps. And in the Arctic, and drums are synonymous with shamanistic activity. Every shaman, there's, you know, drums really around the circumpolar world and most of the world, drums are very heavily a part of ritual. And sometimes, you know, those trances that they can invoke, or performances that are meant to tell morality tales, to maybe scare or create a sense of fear and anxiety about doing certain things that might lead to dangerous outcomes. It can be a part of it, but my interest in drums is much broader than fear. It's just kind of an interest in, because there's so much a part of the identity of Northern peoples, circumpolar peoples. Everybody has their own drum tradition. And I've examined and published just a few little papers. It's something that I'm thinking about doing a Fulbright or something bigger on, because I can't believe nobody's done sort of a circumpolar study of drum traditions. And one of the things, though, however, in regards to fear, not to rant too long about this, this is one of my favorite topics, but there are other colonizing effects where they feared the shaman in Inupiaq and in Inuit society, where drums and other shamanic elements, rattles and things like that, would be destroyed purposefully to take away the power or to diminish the shaman in some ways. So that in itself is kind of this fear of a so-called pagan or evil spirits that didn't fit within Christianity and things like that. So sometimes destruction and disorder, like Ken was talking about earlier, when people are abandoning or purposefully destroying sacred places, those are also outcomes of fear, because they fear an evil presence or some kind of evil influence from those places. So knowing the cultural context is important to be able to try to identify it as a fearful context or for something else.
Yeah. So it's sort of like negotiating, like you're either trying to ward off a negative consequence or you're, you know, the consequence is the direct result of the fear kind of thing. And so Gabe actually had a question on here that I think might tie into that a little bit. And so Newfoundland, it in many ways is kind of a story about cultural extinctions, which is actually something that we don't, or, you know, at least we see the archaeological record sort of cut off a couple of times from particular cultures, and with both the Dorset and later the Beothuk. Are either of those, do you think, linked in any way to a consequence resulting from fear, or is it maybe like trying to negotiate against fear? You know, like I think it's the Dorset, is it, that persists sort of beyond the point that they can, that they've sort of run out of food at a certain point, right? And so is it that there's a fear of changing that maybe motivates them to stay in a place for too long?
And I'm writing a book on this, by the way. Hopefully I should have a book out, I'm hoping by the end of the year, that's actually called Fear and Loathing in the Archaeological Record. At least awesome. That's working title now. And that's one great. Of my main theses is that fear of change is the basis of all fears. It's always a fear of something changing from a state of good or predictability to one of bad or unpredictability or something else. With the Dorset, calling an extinction on Newfoundland is somewhat, I mean, there's debate about this. So many people do call it an extinction. They definitely abandon the island, but they contract to the north, seemingly, and move back to the north, but they abandon the island. That would have, if you think about it from a human perspective, that would have been a very difficult decision that, you know, they probably did hang on longer than necessary, because that's where you've buried your ancestors. That's where all your sacred places that you've ever known for 1,000 years, they're all on that island, really. So to just leave that behind and leave behind everything you knew must have been just like a heartbreaking kind of decision making. And, you know, so they probably had to do it, you know, as people sort of moved out, as they, you know, and I think it has to do with sea ice and seals sort of disappearing and or becoming less predictable. And making it much more difficult. I think they probably would have had the resilience to continue there if there wasn't already other people filling the niches, the people they shared the islands with, the Amerindian, you know, ancestral Beothuk people. If they weren't in some of those other niches, Dorset probably could have shifted and had more of a generalized economy and stayed there. But because of that, it really restricted what they could do. And so I think that led them to contract to the north. But I just can't believe that it wouldn't have been just like a heartbreaking decision. I mean, you think about even the colonial stories that we know of effects of colonization on indigenous peoples who have had to be pushed off their lands that may still even sometimes have some limited or reduced access to those. That in itself has created generational trauma. So I can't imagine that that wasn't occurring with the Dorset on those landscapes. So I think fear has to be a part of that story to some extent.
Apart from that, so fear is sort of like what keeps these traditions going, though, right? Like this is sort of what tradition and potentially tradition in the archaeological record is sort of what persists. Like, so could you argue that fear, like long-standing traditions, are that somebody's so afraid of kind of change that that's what pushes these things? Like, although they're, you know, daily practices and things that repeat over time, staying in that mode might be motivated to a certain extent by fear.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I think that's what we're seeing a lot now generationally, even like in the US. Like some of the political strife we see is sort of many versions of people thinking that the end of the world is near. You know, it's like, but it's really the end of the world as they know it in terms of their own traditions and their beliefs about how culture should be and who should be in power and stuff like that. But with some of these traditions, I mean, I especially see it. I mean, it really, now I'm kind of rambling a bit, but it's, I think it really varies culturally because it depends on your cultural ideology in many ways and your cosmology. Because I think when we see the Ba'athic, I think it is this fear of change where they basically decided to not engage with Europeans, whereas their neighbors all ultimately did, and, you know, somewhat to their detriment, but their neighbors are all still existing. The Ba'athic aren't, you know, as a culture. So I think they had a cultural conservatism with a little c where they wanted to maintain traditions at a cost of ultimately their own cultural extinction. I think by disengaging with the Europeans, which was also ultimately meant a disengagement with much of the coastal areas. And you can't live on that island without coastal resources. There's just not enough in the interior. It's too depauperate to survive on caribou alone, even. That's not good enough. So I think there was definitely a fear of what the Europeans were in terms of almost a contaminant to their culture. Because when you read some of the stories from some of the informants or hostages, however you want to call them, that were recorded, like Shauna Dithit and Damasduit, they talk about having significant contact with Europeans meant that you were going to get punished if you were returned. And that punishment could be very severe. So they saw it as somehow almost like a spiritual contaminant or something of that equivalent. So there was a fear of sustained contact with them, even as they became more and more requiring of some of the materials that the Europeans brought with them, like iron and stuff. They became dependent on that often. But I think that also had, and Don and Holly and I have talked about this a bit, it almost kind of like, it brings with it a value to be able to go and take these materials without having interaction. So it's almost like touching or counting coup or something like that, where you're engaging with the enemy to some extent but taking something back that's useful. And then you're transforming that into your own cultural traditions. I mean, they're not creating new kinds of things. They're just they're incorporating new kinds of materials. So I think having that sort of fear of loss of tradition and stuff really probably ultimately contributed greatly to their cultural extinction. Again, I want to make sure I'm saying cultural extinction because probably some of them ended up with other groups. So it's not a complete biological extinction.
Sure. That's really interesting. So before you came on, we were talking a little bit, and you said you're teaching this semester. Is it an anthropology of horror literature?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I those topics you were just describing seem to me, I don't know that much about horror movies or horror literature, but those themes seem to run through horror movies and horror literature. And, you know, like I'm reminded it's the 50th anniversary, I think, of Carrie, right, this year.
Right.
And I was wondering if you could, for our listener who likes this kind of thing, just talk a little bit about What sort of themes you see in horror literature that are maybe applicable to some of the stuff, or maybe even some book recommendations for our listeners?
So this class is fun because I think if you really want to learn about another culture, learn what they're afraid of. And so I have my students all doing kind of an ethnology of, they have to pick an author that's different from them in some way in a cultural identity, you know, whether it's gender or nationalistic or ethnic or what race, but they have to pick an author, and they do basically an ethnography of this a different author and try to understand the themes that the author is bringing with them to that. So every week we talk about different subjects. We do cover race. We talk about gender. Those are our strong themes right now. For books wise, on thinking about like place and race in horror, there's a new book that came out earlier this year by Tanana Reeve Du called The Reformatory. It's about a reformatory school in Florida, which is kind of an equivalent to like a residential school for indigenous people, where young, poor, and mostly black people were brought to sort of reform them and civilize them. And many of them died. And so it's a haunted place, and it's a brilliant, brilliant book I would highly recommend. And this week in my class, the topic was place, and place is very important. It's a setting and context for everything. You know, cultures are their identities are tied to places. And like, you know, just like the door, like I was talking about with the Dorset, places become ingrained in who you are. And so when those places become corrupted or haunted, or they become haunted because of events or things like that, that's often a major theme you see in horror. But I can't recommend the book I would recommend for people interested in anthropology, particularly indigenous issues and things like that. There's my favorite author is a guy named Stephen Graham Jones. He's Blackfeet, indigenous. He won the Mark Twain Prize for Literature a few years ago for a book that's called The Only Good Indians, which is just one of the most amazing books ever written. It's rare that horror, like a genre novel, gets something like the Mark Twain Prize and gets that kind of recognition, but it's just that good. And horror right now is a really, it's taken on culture in so many ways. So it's a great vehicle to talk about things like culture and fear and society. So it's an incredible kind of class. It's one of my favorite classes to teach for sure.
That's neat. And we'll put those recommendations in the show notes. So Chris, one of the things that, as we're looking at you, you're in, I think, your home office, and I've seen you, I think I've zoomed with you in your office at Albany. You always have interesting things on your shelves. And it seems like sometimes those are little artifacts that involve fear. Am I right about that?
The camera's panning right now.
So Chris, skulls, can you describe that for the listener?
Well, that's just like an old, like it's actually a German, all the stages of human evolution over there. An old map, you know, one of those pull down things they used to bring.
Yeah.
Like in classrooms before we had PowerPoints and stuff, we actually had maps and stuff we pulled down.
Cool.
But I actually collect apotropaic symbols. So my students always bring me things that are like something that to you, the different cultures use to dispel evil. So in my office at work, I have more of these things. I have like little bottles of holy water. I have like evil eyes from, I had some Turkish students that brought me like a little evil eye. I have a student that just went to India and brought me back these different demon masks and things that you hang above your doorway to keep. And often they're things you put on thresholds. So,
interesting.
You know, it's like witch bottles, like putting witch bottles underneath. That's another thing, one of my chapters is about witches and fear of witches. But one of the archaeological signs of that is people would make witch bottles with different ingredients in a bottle, and they'd bury it under like somebody's doorstep or something like that to keep witches from entering into their houses. So you can find some of those, and different cultures have different traditions of that. So I have a bunch of little weird things like that I collect over time.
Huh. So did people put things like that in the fallout shelters that you were studying? Like did you ever go in and they were like a lucky horseshoe over the door of the fallout shelter? Or
I haven't studied sort of personal fallout shelters, but I have seen some where they have like crosses hanging over the doorways and things like that. So that's another, you know, apotropaic symbol. Often you would see, and if you look at, there's a guy named Brian Hoggart that wrote a whole book about magic house symbols. Or I think, I can't remember the name of the book. I can try to send that reference to you if you want.
Yeah, please
but
do.
But he mostly works in England, and in England, they have a long history of carving, Mariana, like different symbols, like the Virgin Mary above the doorway, or carving daisy wheels. And you see those same kinds of things on tombstones as well. So those are often ways to keep evil or to keep ghosts or haunted or evil beings outside of your house. So they're, yeah. So I like to collect things like that.
Yeah. So your office is like the most protected place in North America, basically, with all those all the symbols in it.
Yeah, I have a skull down here with like one of those symbols on its forehead too, on near the window. So not a real skull.
It's it's
a replica.
Yeah, it was pretty weird, listener. When he left Plattsburgh and he had to ritually kill his office, it made everyone very uncomfortable. But they,
oh man, I could have done that up there. That would have been good.
Yeah. So, Chris, we're aware of everyone's Courvoisier status here. That we're getting close to the bottom of our bottles. But we thought we'd maybe just end here with what are some of your upcoming research plans? You alluded to Mi'kmaq collaboration and with regard to coastal occupations. You talked a little bit about some of the work you're planning with Don Holly. What's the kind of immediate plan? And you talked about your book too. But what's some of the immediate plans?
Well, I said there should be some Mi'kmaq collaboration to look at that. That isn't necessarily one of my own plans.
Yeah, yeah.
It might be. It's not a bad idea. I do have some plans to go and try to, I'm writing a grant now to try to look at the demise of the Beothic culture in a larger context. Like I said, from the archaeological record without it being sort of dictated by the written record. But I plan to have a much more multidisciplinary approach. I want to, because it's also happened during the Little Ice Age. So there's also the environmental context and to look at these kinds of things in to see if it wasn't just a story of that we're told, if there's more nuance to the story. But that will also include looking at some written records that haven't had enough attention, like the French interaction with the Beothic, the Dutch interaction with the Beothic, and other things. And it would be a good idea probably to try to think about having Mi'kmaq involved in some of that as well. So that's in the works. Expanding the drum research, which is much more of a collection space. The other research I'm doing is I'm actually trying to think about ways I can go out and look at fear more directly. I'm looking at it kind of indirectly and summarizing and synthesizing. I'm trying to figure out if there's something there, maybe, you know, expand some more of our fallout shelter work. That's possible. And I'm doing some more local New York work, looking at later period, colonial period, immigrant structures. We might be doing a field school, Sean Rafferty and I, this summer, that focuses on some like German immigrants that lived in Albany. So like really kind of more recent stuff for us, but not like 19th century. I have more projects than I have time. Obviously.
Is it because you're afraid of, we can analyze you here. Is it because you're afraid of having too much time on your hands? Is it that, what are you afraid of, Chris?
Yeah. So many things. Everything has been said.
Well, Chris, we really appreciate you coming on. It was a pleasure as always. And we'll have to have you on for your, I think we'll be you might be the first third time guest once your book is out, and we'll do a Fear and Loathing.
We can do a breakdown.
Yeah. I assume you'll be in a bathtub and we'll throw it in throw in a radio as it plays White Rabbit, and then it'll all be.
You have to talk to my lawyer. You have to talk to my lawyer about it.
Exactly. Well, when Raul's ready, you just let us know.
All right.
Thanks so much for coming on, man. And I'm sorry we can't see you at the SAAs. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for coming on, Chris.
Yeah. I wish y'all were there. We're going to have some fun in New Orleans. So
perfect. Eat a po' boy for me. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, have a good night, Chris.
Thanks for coming on, Chris. Well, thanks very much, Chris. And we are on to our hit pieces for this week. And I think we're going to start off with one we actually mentioned during the interview with Chris, which is Brian Jones's posthumous article in Northeastern Anthropology. And that's called Constraints and Assumptions for Modeling the Paleo-Indian Colonization of New England. And that was in Northeast Anthropology. It's issue 91/92. And it's right at the beginning, pages 1 through 18. And what I thought was interesting about this article was it actually deals with some of the topics we were talking about with the peopling of Newfoundland, right? Where what Brian does in this or did in this article was to just sort of play around with some models about how it is that people in the ethnographic record we know colonize new places. So do they all move at once? Do groups go ahead and then come back? So chasing out all these different kinds of topics and applying that in particular to New England. And considering sites like Bull Brook, which is a gigantic Paleo-Indian site in Ipswich, Massachusetts, and considering like what that site actually means, you know, is it an aggregation site? Is it a site at which folks were basically sort of staging or marshalling to get ready for more colonization? And so all that. And so it's a little bit dated. It's based on a conference paper Brian gave in, I think, 2004. And then Elizabeth Chilton and Chris Wolfe kind of polished it up a little bit and published it because, unfortunately, Brian, who was the state archaeologist of Connecticut, was his last job, died a few years back. And so he's missed. It's a good article, and I would encourage you to check it out. I really enjoy articles like this because I think they capture some of what's most interesting about Paleo-Indians, right, which is that they are a fairly recent colonization event of a huge continent. And that's relatively recent in the global scheme of things.
Yeah. In terms of populating narratives, there aren't many that post-date. There aren't many parts of the world that post-date other than like sort of in the South Pacific, basically, that post-dates arriving, you know, the Paleo-Indians moving across the continent, North America.
Yeah, no, that's true. And you actually teach a course that includes the Pacific ones, don't you?
Yeah. America's and Oceania. So I teach it. I'm going to be teaching it again this fall. It's crazy. It's like one of those things that you don't think about that Hawaii didn't have people on it till about 1450 CE. So, you know, like there were people like conceivably Europeans fishing off the coast of North America at the same time the first Polynesian cultures reached the island of Hawaii.
That's great. And listener, if you would like us to do an on-location episode about Hawaii, you can just send the check and the airfare.
There you go. Yeah. We could meet up with Bill Belcher.
We could. Yeah. He only spends half the year there now, I'm told.
But, oh, okay.
Yeah, but that would be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to this issue. I think you get yours shipped to New Hampshire. Yeah. So the postage comes through. Mine's probably in customs right now while they...
They
search it. So, and on that, there's actually another paper from this issue of Northeast Anthropology that you've had the chance to take a look at. And I think following up on a paper that David McInnes published in Archaeology of Eastern North America a couple of years ago on population.
Yeah, that's right. So Dave McInnes's article in the same issue of Northeast Anthropology, Population Dynamics, Mobility, and Pottery Use Among Hunter-Gatherers on the Maritime Peninsula of North America. And so the listeners heard briefly from Dave before. He was on Dave McInnes before. He was on the field school last summer. So he volunteers on the field school many summers and also teaches students about population dynamics. But he uses the dates as data method. So using radiocarbon dates as a proxy for relative rates of population. And in this paper, he tries to track population dynamics through the woodland period. So basically, he can kind of chase the kind of ebb and flow of population. It's a relative measure. I shouldn't say not just through the wooden period. He does it through the whole occupation of the Maritime Peninsula. And he also considers, while he's doing that, the possible implications for the development of pottery in the region and for some interesting patterning in the apparent abundance of population throughout basically throughout the woodland period. So why does the seeming amount of pottery in the archaeological record change? And I think as they would be the first to admit, there is a fair bit of debate about this. And I, for one, think it's a really welcome contribution to the archaeology of the region. And I'm glad to see it in print. And I think the method is really cool. And I think it's, you know, just a really important conversation to bring this kind of, like, so I guess to walk it back a little bit, Ken and I, we've talked a little bit about, it seems nice that archaeology in the Maritime Peninsula has felt in recent years to me to be more of an exciting kind of high-end place in the sense that we've got people doing all sorts of different kinds of work here.
Yeah, yeah, and I think it's important too, right? It's
absolutely.
It's kind of shifted things. You know, I think we're still doing really important, like, kind of culture history stuff in the background, but I think there's also a lot of work that's coming out now that's kind of pushing narratives and really integrating Maritime's data sets into these bigger conversations about Northeast and North American archaeology more generally.
That's right. And so so that's very exciting. And so I guess sort of speaking to that, Ken, our next up is we've got a paper by Alec McCullen and Cora Woolsey that thinks a little bit about CRM, which I'll hand over to you to talk about. That's you have the CRM portfolio on this.
Exactly. That's in my wheelhouse. So the paper is called Thematic Analysis of Indigenous Perspectives on Archaeology and Cultural Resource Management Industries. And that is coming out in American Antiquity right now. It is a first view article. So it's basically available online. What's interesting about this article, so Alec and Cora developed a survey that was focused on kind of thematic questions centered around Indigenous perspectives on archaeology and in particular on CRM. So the themes that they kind of argue about are sort of the importance, comprehension, challenges, accessibility, methods, and software related to archaeology and how interpretations of those. And so there's sort of a series of questions in each of these themes that kind of results in an interesting breakdown in perspectives from a number of Indigenous community members, several of whom are involved in archaeology or are in heritage offices within their communities, bringing in kind of talking about a number of issues that are kind of contemporary. So they kind of lead off contextualizing this all in sort of the model geopolitical and legislative and policy context about Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada, UNDRIP, so the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People, and how CRM has sort of grappled with these legislative and policy changes and how, you know, the pace of CRM work tends to fly in the face of many of the tenets of sort of slow archaeology and archaeology that's being done at the consent of and at the behest of Indigenous communities. And so there's a number of commentaries here about the pace and extent of CRM archaeology, the quality of the work, and whether or not technical writing and data is accessible in ways that are useful to communities. And some of the perceptions about just sort of the ways that we collect data as being inconsistent. And so I think it's a really interesting thought piece on this. It's got some interesting data in it. It'll be interesting to see, too, if this sort of article motivates bigger scale, larger data sets that that bring in a kind of a broader perspective, too, from those communities. So, but interesting read. And I don't know if that would be open access, but
it had the open access tag on it, although it occurs to me I'm not actually sure if it's open access until before it comes out, so
right.
Maybe I think it's gonna be open access when it comes out,
yeah, which would probably be in May. Would that be right?
I think that's correct.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to add to that, congratulations to them as well for getting this in American Antiquity. I think it's really nice to see. And so even though this isn't really a regional paper, it's nice to see folks from the region publishing in the big journals.
Yeah,
so,
and it's really important.
It really is. And I think, it's sort of like that idea that you kind of can't have new old institutions, right? You have to engage with the old institutions to sort of build the profile of a place. And I think Alec and Cora have done that here with an American Antiquity paper. So very well done to both of them. Well, Ken, I think we are looking at we've traveled through time.
We have traveled through time a couple of times.
We have. And so I think that we, it's been very weird to watch the Courvoisier rising and falling like the tides as we do this.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Our hairlines, I think, change throughout the tidal flow.
No, Ken, that's just my beard expanding as the Oh, yeah. Maybe I'm more bald. I don't know. So, Ken, I think we're about ready to let the listener go for another fortnight. And we hope they enjoyed this episode. And we are looking forward to chatting with them soon. We're looking forward to seeing any of our Prairie listeners at Saskatoon.
Yeah. And we will have lots of swag. So and a wide variety of swags in order to pass out. So we look forward to meeting you, talking about the podcast. And if you are presenting on anything, if you're presenting a poster or a paper, and you're interested in having a chat with us and having us promote that through the podcast, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. We're happy to talk to you, and we love hearing what people are doing and what they're presenting at conferences and sharing that with our listeners.
We really do. So we're looking forward to chatting. And well, listener, we will see you in about a fortnight.
We'll see you later, listener.